Hello and welcome back to the Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, your airline pilot. And let's see, right now I'm in Dayton, Ohio. Kind of a rainy, cold day here. But anyway, got a lot to talk about on this show. So sit back, relax, enjoy the ride. Hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving holiday. I know I did. Just our family this year. My wife's family was out of town, and normally we get together with them in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area, that is. And so it was just us, and a friend of my oldest daughter's came up from Orlando, and so we had a guest there. And let's see, I had a request in for some overtime flying on well, I have a standing request to pick up overtime flying, and I was kind of monitoring what was happening with the flights on Thursday, and looked pretty quiet, actually. The weather was good across the country. I really didn't expect to be called out, but I got a call right around 5:30, and they told me that they needed me to come in and fly an airplane down to Panama City, and so I did that, and then spent a short night there and deadheaded the next morning back to Atlanta. So I was really just gone for our Thanksgiving dinner, and it actually worked out pretty well because I got to eat all the leftovers, and there was a lot left over. My wife always fixes way too much food. And I didn't have to do any of the dishes. Well, for the most part, there were still some dishes soaking that I got a chance to clean when I got back home on Friday. Now, a listener, a good friend of mine, I say good friend, he feels like he's a good friend. He's been a listener, and he sends me feedback quite often. Scott Brimmer, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce his name because I've never talked to him personally. But hey, Scott, hey, let me know exactly how to pronounce your last name. Is it Brimmer or Brimmer, or have we already done this before? Well, anyway, regardless, he lives down in Panama City, and I thought about calling him up, and then I'm thinking, no. It's in the evening on Thanksgiving, and I'm only going to be here long enough to really, you know, just get a decent night's sleep and then head back home to Atlanta the next day. But just wanted to let you know, Scott, that I have actually now flown into the new Panama City Airport, KECP. And Scott tells me that that stands for Everybody Come Play or Everyone Come Party or something like that. I don't think I've met anybody yet who can tell me a definitive answer on exactly what that code stands for. But anyway, a nice airport, nice long runway, I think about 10,000 feet out in the middle of nowhere. Dark when we came in. It was nice and clear night, but it was dark. And but the runway was easy to see for quite a ways away with the lights on and everything. So nice airport there, Scott. And next time I'm there and I have a little bit of a time, I'll give you a call and we get together and have a beer or something. Anyway, now, this is just in. I was doing some research for the show just to see if there was anything on liveatc.net, you know, the place where they have recordings of air traffic control conversations, pilot conversations, and such. And I just happened to see a file uploaded as I was browsing the site, and it just happened a few hours ago. I'm recording this on the 29th of November, Tuesday the 29th, and I think that it happened sometime today around noon or, you know, midday, and it was in the Chicago area, a lifeguard flight, a flight carrying an ill passenger, 80-year-old man with some kind of a blood infection, and his wife, also an elderly lady. We're being carried from West Palm Beach, Florida, in a Piper Navajo. That's a kind of a small to medium twin airplane made by Piper. And they had two pilots on board and a paramedic, and then, of course, the elderly couple. They stopped in Georgia for refueling, and then they continued up to Chicago. As they were approaching the Chicago area, apparently they ran out of fuel and crashed. And I have this bit of air traffic control recording to present to to you. Yeah, let's listen in.
Sucker 773, direct to Tammy. You just kind of maintain 2,400.
Okay, the I think they were requesting it direct to the outer, or the final approach fix, which is the last fix on the glide path heading to the airport. And I'm not sure exactly what their position is in relation to that fix right now, but so they just requested a direct course to that final approach fix, which is usually about 5 miles from the end of the runway.
Fletcher 773, flight heading of 290. I can't give you an IOS at Tammy. I have to turn you on outside of Tammy. I'm sorry, who's declaring an emergency? Fletcher 773, you are declaring an emergency?
Yes, ma'am.
Fletcher 773, you still want to land Milwaukee?
9773 unable. We are out of fuel and we are coasting.
Fletcher 773, do you have the airport in sight?
Negative. What are the clouds out there, please?
The cloud deck is 1,400 feet overcast.
Okay, he just asked what the, obviously they're in the clouds, they're in instrument meteorological conditions, they're out of fuel, and they're just basically gliding and descending, and he is asking the air traffic controller if she knows what the cloud bases are. I guess he's hoping that they'll be able to descend below the cloud deck and be able to see something and land, hopefully an airport.
Going to be coasted down, and we'll let you know when we got visual on something. We're going straight to the field.
Fletcher 773, roger. Fletcher 773, low altitude alert, guys. MDA in your area is 2,400.
Okay, and that's the last transmission made by Lifeguard Piper 773. She issued a low altitude alert. She said that 2,400 feet was their minimum vectoring altitude in that area, which means that that is the minimum altitude that air traffic control can descend a flight and still have a reasonable amount of clearance from obstacles and terrain. And apparently they were still in the weather at that point. And a short while later, there were reports that a plane crashed in a wooded area just north of a Lake County Forest Preserve, ripping apart trees and barely missing a family home. Let's see, three people dead. The patient, the 80-year-old man suffering the blood infection, his wife, and one of the pilots, a 58-year-old pilot up there. And it looks like the two others on board, the younger voice pilot and the paramedic, survived and were taken to the Advocate Condell Medical Center in Libertyville and are expected to live. Yeah, sad news. Looks like fuel starvation is the cause of this accident. Still a lot to find out about this particular accident and why they were flying around in that kind of weather without adequate fuel reserves. And that's why we, at the scheduled airlines, fly around with plenty of extra fuel, just in case we're in a situation where we need to divert to another airport or make an approach to an airport and go around, maybe even hold a while, and then, you know, waiting for the weather to get better or make some other plan of action and then divert to an alternate destination. Sad. Okay, well, let's see. What else do I have to talk about? I have a lot of stuff, a lot of feedback from you, my great listeners. Let's start with this. Mentioned on the last podcast, Michael O'Leary, the CEO of Ryanair. You know, he's the dude that wants you to pay for using the loo, the toilets, and he wants only one pilot up there in the front because, you know, having more than one is just redundant. And let's see what else. He wants to have everybody standing in the back and not sitting down in seats. Anyway, he was at a news conference a couple weeks ago and he talked about the fact that he was going to start charging and offering pornography and on personal devices. Excuse me. And that was pointed out by several of the of you, my listeners. And I reported that. And then it turns out that, let's see, Paul sent this to me. Thought you might be interested in this article from The Guardian here in the UK. It gives a bit more detail on what Michael O'Leary really said about pornography on planes. It still doesn't excuse the terrible way Ryanair treats its customers. Unfortunately, there are many times in Europe when it's the only choice. Yeah, so they're the low-cost leader, I guess, in Europe. And apparently you can get pretty good prices, very, very cheap airfares on Ryanair. And then I guess they just nickel and dime you for everything else. But this is interesting. Again, a case of the media misquoting or mischaracterizing something that somebody has said. And let me read this to you. I was asked, this is a Michael O'Leary speaking, quote, I was asked what the next thing or the next thing would be, and I said probably passengers paying for access to the internet. They'll watch whatever's on their tablets. Gambling, racing, pornography. Next question, are you going to have porn on your flights? I said, of course, if that's what's on people's tablets. And then somebody was wittering, what about the child sitting next to you? And then the writer of this article from The Guardian says, but they had a point, hadn't they? After all, watching porn is one thing in the privacy of a hotel room and quite another as you're descending into Rocław with a shameful grin and a five-year-old glimpsing your screen from across the aisle. So anyway, to clarify what he said is that he's not specifically going to be offering, you know, pornography on his airplanes. He's just going to be offering the internet. And turns out that just recently here in the news, you may have heard about this just a couple days ago on the 27th of November, on a Delta Airlines flight from Salt Lake City to Boston, a passenger was doing just what Michael O'Leary, the CEO of Ryanair, was describing. It's somebody, you know, using the internet on their personal electronic device. And in this case, this man was viewing child pornography. Let's see, it's a University of Utah chemistry professor, Grant Smith. He was sitting in first class. I guess they pay these university professors pretty well, sitting in first class, when another passenger saw the pornographic images on a laptop and alerted the crew. And let's see, according to the prosecutors, a passenger seated behind Smith's first class seat on the Delta flight on Saturday took a picture of what Smith was doing and sent a text message to his son with the picture asking his son to contact Massachusetts police. The passenger also alerted a flight attendant who confronted Smith and ordered him to shut off his computer, which happened to be the property of the University of Utah. After being contacted by the flight attendant, Smith allegedly tried to erase images from his computer. The images were mostly of girls between 6 and 10 years old, naked or nearly naked, engaging in simulated sex acts. Lovely. Well, he was met when the flight arrived in Boston and escorted off and arrested for viewing child or being in possession of and viewing child pornography. You know, not cool, dude. Let's see, this, I'm reading this from airsafenews.com. The airsafe.com website publishes a baggage and security guide. And, in this, they, talk about what passengers can or should be able to do with their laptop or other personal electronic device. And, so let's start here. I'll just kind of read a little bit of this. The First Amendment and Personal Electronic Devices. In the United States, the First Amendment of the Constitution forms the basis of laws and traditions when it comes to freedom of speech, which includes the right of adults to possess or view most, but not all, forms of sexually oriented material. One of the few limitations on speech is in the area of obscene material, specifically material that has been legally determined to be sexually explicit, offensive to conventional standards of decency, and lacking in serious literary, scientific, artistic, or political value. While it may be difficult for the average person to identify obscene material, one type that is very easy to spot is child pornography. which is any kind of visual depiction of a person under the age of 18 engaged in sexually explicit conduct. This conduct does not have to involve either sexual acts or nudity, though in this alleged incident, the images contain both nudity and simulated sexual activity. This kind of material is illegal for anyone in the United States to view, possess, or publish. And it goes on, what to do if you see child porn in flight? If you're on an airplane and you see what appears to be images or videos depicting what we've been talking about here, bring it to the attention of a cabin crew member immediately. This appears to be exactly what the passengers did during the recent incident on the Delta flight to Boston. If this is not possible and you're arriving at a U.S. airport, contact a law enforcement representative after you land. If you're landing at a non-U.S. airport, use your best judgment as to whether you should report what you saw. And just as a general rule, there are some guidelines here about passenger behavior and electronic devices. Airline policies, and especially the cabin crew on your flight, usually are quite clear about when portable electronic devices can and cannot be used on the aircraft. What is not quite as clear is what is an acceptable use of these devices. Federal laws may affect when you can use a personal electronic device, but airline policies and social conventions may limit how you use your device. Avoiding the potential embarrassment of having a flight attendant ask you to turn off your device or avoiding the wrath of your fellow passengers is easy if you follow these common sense suggestions for appropriate behavior. Avoid making excessive noise. When playing music or videos, use headphones or earphones. For other devices that don't have a headphone jack, turn off the audio. If that's not possible, don't use the device. If you're on the phone, there's no need to speak loudly enough to be heard across the cabin. If you want to use some kind of voice recording device during the flight, and that's within the rules, exercise some judgment. And don't do it loudly or for long periods. I think they're talking to me, you know, recording a podcast on board a flight. Let's see. Avoid displaying inappropriate images. Duh. Okay. We don't need to talk about that anymore, do we? Don't photograph people without their permission. Inside an aircraft, there is a certain expectation of privacy. While it may be tempting to shoot a funny picture or video of that snoring passenger across the aisle, don't do it without asking first. And don't photograph unaccompanied children. It's customary to get a parent or guardian's permission before photographing a child, but that's not possible with a child traveling alone. Furthermore, to other passengers and to the crew, a person taking pictures or shooting a video of an unaccompanied child may look either creepy or suspicious. Yeah, very. Okay, so here are some guidelines. I mean, that's common sense, isn't it? So, to repeat, clarification, thank you, Paul, for sending me that feedback. Clarification on what Michael O'Leary said. In this case, he's not so sleazy as we thought. Well, maybe, yeah, I said not so sleazy as we thought. And an example of somebody doing sleazy things on board an airplane and being arrested for it. Looks like he may actually lose his job. Also, I was looking at an article regarding this whole incident from one of the Utah news outlets. And they said that they had been searching his home and his office at work. And let's see, what was I going to say? Oh, they said that just this past Friday, so I guess the day before this incident occurred, he had just received the final outcome of his divorce decree. Apparently his wife left him, and he has two children, 8 and 11, I believe. So anyway, there's a little update on pornography in flight. And this I just found as well. Just happened very recently on Friday, actually. Speaking of electronic devices, you know, they say Apple's iPhones are always among the hottest gadgets of any holiday shopping season, but for one passenger on an Australian flight, the phone was too hot to handle, literally. While on an Australian flight, a regional airline, I think it was a Saab 340, a passenger's iPhone 4, not the 4S, which is the latest iPhone model, suddenly started emitting a significant amount of dense smoke accompanied by a red glow. And they were just, I think they were in the midst of landing when this incident occurred. And after they landed, the flight attendant carried out recovery actions immediately, and the red glow was extinguished successfully. So it was a happy ending, but I have a picture of the iPhone in the article, and it looks like it definitely got hot. Looks like a case of those lithium-ion batteries getting overheated or shorting or something. So another electronic device update. So be careful if you have an iPhone out there. It might actually get a little bit too hot to handle. And let's see, I think I had another piece of feedback about electronic devices. Oh yeah, this was in response to what I was saying about, you know, the rules about whether or not we should be able to use them or not, and, you know, following the rules and discipline, etc. You know how I feel about that. And I got this from, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Kopa or Kapa Dasao. I think he's from Turkey. I'm not sure. Let me know, Kopa or Kapa. First of all, send me some feedback and let me know how to pronounce your name so I can get it right. Or send me some voicemail. That would be even better. And anyway, he writes, screw the rules. It isn't the rules that are important when it comes to turning off electronic devices during takeoff and landing. It's attention. Passengers need their attention available in an instance in case of an emergency during the critical times during flight. Having their attention locked on a device reduces reaction times when immediate reaction are necessary. And then there's the topic about loose items flying around the cockpit. In an emergency, such devices would pose an additional risk to anyone in the cabin. A loose iPod could be lethal. Excuse me, during a plane crash. So yeah, I say screw the rules and screw FAA. Now this is not me speaking, folks. Not Captain Jeff here. This is the feedback from my listener. This isn't about rules or if electronic devices pose a threat to avionics. It's about life and death. Well, very strongly put, Kopa. And yeah, I agree. And you know what? I was deadheading last week, and I was reading my Sky magazine or the Sky Mall, you know, the little, you know, in-flight catalog that they have in the seat back. And I'm thinking, you know, I agreed with you, or I have agreed with the idea that we need to have our attention, you know, as we need to be as alert as possible during takeoffs and landings and that kind of thing. But, you know, I look around and people are reading newspapers and reading novels and reading the Sky Mall and the Sky Magazine, et cetera, thinking, well, those are distractions as well. So maybe we should ban that. I don't know. Just a thought. But thank you for your feedback, sir. I appreciate it. Okay. Let's see. How long have we been going here? I don't want to run this thing too long. I know I've already been yapping for quite some time. Right at about 24 minutes. Okay, I'm going to continue. I have so much more to talk about here. Received some feedback from Brian in Indonesia. You remember me reading some of his feedback he sent? He sent me some voicemail feedback, I believe, and some pictures, et cetera. I think I played on the show several months back. Well, let's see. This is what he said. This is in response to the article or the news item that I talked about last episode, where a couple was suing AirTran for seeing a cockroach or two in the overhead bin. Captain Jeff, hi, it's Brian from Indonesia again. You read my last feedback and shared my YouTube videos back in episode 10. Oh, thanks. Couldn't remember when that was, but episode 10. Thanks for doing that. You asked at the time what animal the guy had on his private area. It's actually a gourd, or a gourd, called a koteka. They vary in size and shape depending on the tribe. Many things can actually be stored inside the koteka, including money, which is something I try not to think about when accepting their ticket money. Sorry I didn't get back to you on that sooner. Anyway, no problem. Anyway, if I can remember, I will bring you one when I come to the U.S. for a break next June. New, of course, not used. Well, thanks. That'd be great. I'd love to have a cotica. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but I'm sure that you'll let me know. The reason why I'm sending this feedback is a story about the couple suing AirTran for the cockroach in the air vent. If we got sued every time a cockroach or other type of bug came out of a crack or crevice in our airplanes, we'd be out of business a long time ago. As you can imagine, in a tropical rainforest setting, we get gigantic bugs out there, or out here. Lots of them find their way into the structure of the plane and make occasional appearances. We do bug bomb the planes every 100 hours or so, or as needed. Once, I had a large spider come out of the instrument panel right where the yoke goes in. So it was just inches from my hand. Not knowing if it was poisonous or not, I tried to move it along with a chart. The problem is that once it disappears back into the bowels of the plane, you never know when it will show up again. I say, out of sight, out of mind, right? We actually have another pilot that is so deathly afraid of bugs. When he first started, the chief pilot was worried he could lose control of the plane if a bug landed on him. So it was immersion training for him. The chief pilot kept throwing live bugs, roaches, spiders, and the like at him in random intervals to see his reaction. We even get a type of beetle here that is completely harmless but grows to over 2 inches in diameter. Ugh. And has mean-looking pinchers. The chief pilot put one on his leg on final to see what would happen. Glad to say, he survived. We didn't lose the airplane and seems to be quite a bit better now, although he carries a big can of Raid with him in his flight bag. The locals all think this is funny. Of course, when they see a big bug like a roach or a beetle, they are thinking, yum, dinner. Suing over a couple of bugs is ridiculous. It proves yet again what a moronic and litigious society we have. The idea that they can bring such frivolous lawsuits just to try to get a quick buck that they didn't earn ought to be a warning message to all of us. We are right on the brink. Yeah, you're right, Brian. Your avid listener from Papua, Brian Pottinger. And he's the pilot for Associated Mission Aviation. Thanks again for your feedback, Brian. It's always interesting to hear what is going on in Indonesia. And hey, if you're going to bring me one of those gourds, put some of that good Indonesian coffee in it too. Oh, I love that. It's my favorite kind. Okay. Oh, this is funny. This just happened a couple days ago. There was an airplane that came into a a smaller airport. I think Houston Executive Airport. This guy was flying a twin-engine beach aircraft, landed at the airport at about 8:30 p.m., and it said that the plane came in so fast and made such a hard landing that it collapsed the nose wheel and came skidding to a stop, and out comes the pilot running away, trying to pick up bags and bundles of something, and it turns out that the something that he was trying to carry with him but wasn't completely successful, were bundles of marijuana. I think he was carrying about 100 pounds or so. Yeah, 100 pounds of marijuana was found near the airplane. And apparently he's still on the loose. There is arrest warrant out for this man. His name is something Slack. Barrington Carl Slack, 33 years old. Apparently, he's been in trouble with the law in the past in Georgia. He was the target of a narcotics trafficking investigation. And I think that he crashed an airplane there October of last year. And it says published reports showed that he survived the crash by parachuting to safety. And apparently, they have a pretty thick file on him. And so I guess that his vocation is drug trafficking using airplanes. And in this case, not a very good outcome for him. So they're on to you, man. If you're listening to my podcast, turn yourself in. So that's crazy. Let's see, what next? Received some email from Gary Moshier. Let's see. He's in Pittsburgh. And Wolfram Alpha, you may have heard of the name. They're a company that does a kind of a scientific search engine and statistical search engine. And apparently they have a new feature called, well, what do they call it? Well, I'm not sure what they call it. But if you go to Wolfram Alpha, that's Wolfram Alpha, Alpha, all one word. It's a search engine. And if you put in the search field, flights overhead, you'll get information on aircraft that should be visible to you because it knows where you are, I guess, assuming clear sky and an unobstructed view. If you're on a location-aware mobile device, the results will be based on your precise latitude and longitude. Otherwise, Wolfram Alpha will use the best available location information from your browser. Also note that the that hovering over an individual plane in the sky map will produce a tooltip with the airline and flight number. So it has some screenshots here from Wolfram Alpha, and I did it myself just to see how it worked, and it was pretty slick. Let's see, somebody, again, the screenshot here shows flights overhead, and they hit enter. And then in this example, there was an American Eagle Airlines flight 3966 at 16,200 feet, and it shows the angle from your geographic location. In this case, it was 29 degrees up. I'm not sure exactly what that means, if it's 29 degrees as far as a magnetic, like a compass direction, or if it's 29 degrees from the horizon. I'm not sure. But it has this nifty graphic that it shows as well, and these little airplanes flying around, and as the article mentioned, you can just kind of put your cursor over the top of one of these, and it shows the flight number and altitude and I think speed. Anyway, pretty cool. So thank you, Gary, for sending that in to me, and everybody else, check it out. Okay. Going on with the feedback theme, this is from Private Pilot Ron, and I should have read his feedback earlier when I was talking about porn. He said he couldn't believe the news item where I mentioned the Ryanair plan to stream pornography. He says, I'm not coming from a religious point of view, and I'm not saying that we should be crazy, making folks walk the plank at flight level 250 just for using language that's as salty as the peanuts, but we do need to keep it clean and civil, at least at the way we usually do in public, be it a restaurant, mall, or coffee house. The airline to be streaming porno for profit isn't really the way to that end, in my opinion, and I won't miss it if they abolish the porno channels for the video offerings on my next flight. I'd rather not explain those choices to someone else's 8-year-old kid who happens to be seated next to me as I skip past them as fast as I can. Can you imagine the flight's captain decided there'll be no porn streaming from the equipment on my flight? And she or he unplugged the video streaming device? Seems to me like that's well within the authority of a captain, don't you? Love your podcasts. Keep them coming. Thank you, Ron. Yeah, I agree. I think that's within the authority of a captain. I don't know. Maybe not. But so, yeah, again, thanks for the feedback, Ron. Keep listening and sending me more feedback. Okay. And this, I did a little research on this one. This was an interesting question, some interesting feedback sent in by Todd. And here it goes. Hi, Captain Jeff. Recently discovered your podcast after tearing through several seasons of the Fantastic Air Crash Investigation series on television, which is really good. I've watched that as well. Good series. I was wondering if you might be able to help a layperson better understand the concept of a flat spin. I'm hoping to learn more about the circumstances under which a plane enters into a flat spin and why recovery is so difficult in this scenario. I'm thinking specifically about the incident that occurred in Ukraine in 2006, Pulkovo Flight 612, in which the airplane climbed above its maximum operating altitude, stalled, and went into an unrecoverable spin. Thanks for taking the time to produce a very enjoyable and enlightening podcast. Best regards, Todd. Well, thanks. I'm glad you found my podcast and continue to listen and send me feedback, Todd. And so I did a little bit of research. I wasn't familiar with the Bulkovo Aviation Enterprise Flight 612. It was a Russian-made Tupolev Tu-154. And if you can imagine what a 727 looks like, you know, the T-tail and three engines in the back, swept wing airplane, looks like a 727 ski, a Russian version of the 727. Apparently, it's a little bit bigger than a 727 and can carry a little bit more. And it's actually, it's kind of a cool airplane. It was designed to fly in some unimproved field conditions. It has, the 727 had two main gear tires on each main landing gear pod on each wing. So they had four main landing gear wheels, and the Tupolev 154 actually has, I think, six wheels on each truck, each main landing gear truck on each side of the airplane. So there's like 12 main landing gear wheels in addition to the two nose wheels. And I apologize for that air conditioning noise in the background. I think that my heater just came on because it's really getting kind of cold here in my room in Dayton. Anyway, so pretty beefy landing gear on this airplane. And, as I said, it looks kind of like a 727, only a little bit bigger. The crash investigation report concluded the cause of the crash of the Tupolev 154, was the aircraft entering into manual flight mode. Again, we have a situation where there was automation going on, and then for some reason it entered into manual flight mode, and supercritical angles of attack and stall mode with the subsequent transition to a flat spin and collision with the ground with a large vertical velocity occurred. Interesting, the last sentence of this report says, lack of control over flight speed and not allowing the instructions of the flight manual to prevent the aircraft entering a stall, and poor crew coordination allowed the situation to escalate into a catastrophic one. Yet another, and this just happened back in 2006, just a few years ago. Again, in the last 10 to 20 years, so many of our crashes have occurred because pilots are controlling or flying the airplane manually, and apparently either were not taught how to fly or have forgotten how to fly because they're relying so much on automation. So in this case, the pilot crew got into a situation in which they could not recover. And so, and I was wondering, spins. You know, I did a lot of spins in the Air Force. Part of our undergraduate flight training involves going up in the T-37, and just about every what we call basic ride or every aerobatic ride. You know, we have aerobatics training, we have formation training, we have instrument training, and we have navigation training. Basically, the four major subject areas in our undergraduate flight training syllabus. And the bulk of it is going out there and just basically doing, you know, loops and aileron rolls and barrel rolls and all kinds of fun aerobatic maneuvers. And one of the things we do right off the bat is, of course, you know, show what it's like to get into a stall and how to recover from a stall. And then, of course, an aggravated stall with adverse yaw, you can get into a situation in which the airplane is in a spin. And then we practice getting into the spin and recovering from the spin. And a spin is an aggravated stall resulting in an auto-rotation about the spin axis, wherein the aircraft follows a corkscrew downward path. Spins can be entered intentionally or unintentionally from any flight attitude and from practically any airspeed. All that's required is sufficient yaw while an aircraft is stalled. In either case, however, a specific and often counterintuitive set of actions may be needed for an effective recovery to be made. If the aircraft exceeds published limitations regarding spins or is loaded improperly, or if the pilot uses incorrect technique to recover, the spin can lead to a crash. So in a spin, one or both of the wings are in a stalled condition. If both are stalled, one wing will be in a deeper stall than the other. And this causes the aircraft to auto-rotate or yaw towards the deeper stalled wing due to its higher drag. So let's see. Now, spins they differ from spiral dives, which are characterized by low angle of attack and high airspeed. So a spiral dive would be, you know, the wing is still flying and creating lift and, you know, just heading down toward the earth at a very high rate of speed and spiraling. A spin, on the other hand, is when the airplane is either one or both wings is stalled. So it's kind of just flailing in a corkscrew and in many cases in a very flat attitude. And, you know, the term flat spin and not so flat spin, I'm not sure if that's the right term. There was a table here in this Wikipedia article. Yeah, I guess I didn't copy that. That kind of defined different angles of attack as far as whether... Oh, here it is. The NASA spin mode classification. A flat spin is generally angle of attack range 65 to 90 degrees. So, you know, you're pretty much upright. The nose is not really pointed too far down or vertically. Moderately flat is 45 to 65 degrees. Moderately steep, 30 to 45 degrees. And steep, 20 to 30 degrees. And so basically the nose is pointed down quite exaggeratedly. Let's see. You know, I when I'm reading this and I did the research on spins, every Air Force trained pilot will remember these words. And I believe there are 43 words. And this is boldface. And when I say boldface, these are action items that you must have memorized. And you must spout out word for word. Now, you can't just kind of get it sort of right. You have to say every word you have either written down or stated verbally. Exactly these words in the right order. And the T-37 spin recovery. Okay, come, you know, say it along with me, guys. For those of you out there who were trained on the T-37. Throttles idle, rudder and ailerons neutral. Stick abruptly full aft and hold. Rudder abruptly apply full rudder opposite spin direction, opposite turn needle and hold. Stick abruptly full forward one turn after applying rudder. Controls neutral after spinning stops and recover from dive. So that is the spin recovery technique. Not technique, procedure that we used in the T-37. T-37, by the way, if you're not familiar with that airplane, is the initial jet trainer. It was, not anymore. I think they've actually retired that airplane. Made by Cessna, kind of a straight-winged twin jet engine jet. You sit side by side, so the flight instructor and the student are sitting you know, right next to each other, not, you know, one in front of the other, like the T-38. And it's essentially the airplane that most pilots, the first jet that most pilots ever fly. And it's where you kind of learn a lot about flying jets. Anyway, back to our spin discussion. So basically you have a really high angle of attack. You have a stalled situation. The airplane is spinning, and it can be actually quite violent. And it's kind of scary the first time or two or three that you do this. It's very intimidating. Let me just put it that way. And we got up to about as high as we could take a T-37. A T-37 is not a pressurized airplane, so you know you're sucking oxygen. You have your oxygen mask on with your helmet, and you have a parachute. And it has an ejection seat and all that kind of stuff. But I think the service ceiling on the T-37 was 25,000 feet. And we'd always get into a high area, which is, you know, anywhere from about 15 to 25,000 feet. And you'd get as close to that top of that area as you could, because this spin and recovery could take many thousands of feet before you recovered. And by the time you are in the recovery phase, this thing is pointed straight down and you're pulling, you know, considerable G-forces to recover and stay in your area. But Anyway, the recovery depends on the airplane. Some airplanes are kind of designed to spin and to teach spinning. And, you know, honestly, you could probably just let go of the controls and the airplane would eventually recover from it. And, you know, air would start flowing over the wings and everything would be just fine. Usually you have to do a procedure, as I just mentioned, where you just kind of, you know, take the thrust off the propulsion, whether it be a jet or a prop airplane, and neutralize your controls. And then you abruptly apply full aft stick. And that maneuver right there is not necessarily something you do in all airplanes, but you did it in the T-37 just in case you were in an inverted spin. And then you abruptly apply full rudder opposite the spin direction. Of course, that counters the yaw that you're in. And it says here in parentheses, opposite turn needle. That's just because you may be confused about what direction you're actually turning. Because, as I said, it's pretty kind of a violent maneuver. You're really kind of getting tossed about in the cockpit. And so you look at your turn needle. If it's, you know, pointed to the left, then you put full right rudder. And trust me, you do not want to put the wrong rudder in. If it's spinning to the left, you don't want to stomp on the left rudder. Trust me. It just makes it a lot worse. You do the opposite direction, so that kind of, you know, slows the yaw or lessens the yaw and slows the rotation. And then after one turn after doing that, you abruptly apply the stick full forward. And what that does is it kind of, you know, relieves the, it kind of gets the wing flying again. And then you neutralize the controls after the spinning stops and you recover from the dive. It's as easy as that. Now, problem is that even airplanes that are designed to spin, if they're loaded improperly and the center of gravity is out of whack when it comes to its location in regard to the center of lift, you could be in a situation where you can't recover from it. And there are some airplanes that are just, if you get into a spin, you can't recover from them, no matter how hard you try to do this recovery maneuver. So I guess that was a case in this this Tupolev crash in 2006. The airplane was never designed to get into a spin. And how do you recover from a spin? Well, you just don't ever get into it. And how do we prevent that from happening? Teaching people what it's like to be in a stall or what leads up to a stall and to prevent it. So anyway, so I know that was just a cursory discussion about spins, Todd, but if I didn't answer your question, send me some follow-up feedback. And if anybody else listening has any more input about spins or maybe some experiences with spins, send it in. It's always interesting to hear about it. That brought up a lot of memories that I had, especially as an instructor in the T-37. I'd go out and some of my sorties were just nothing but spins from the beginning to the end, 1.3 hours. Well, not quite. We had to go out there to the area and then come back, so that took some time. Okay. And, I had some voice feedback. Here, let me take a peek again, see how many minutes I'm into this. Oh, gosh. Almost 50 minutes. Darn it. I keep going so long in these things. Sorry about that. I have some voicemail feedback from, let's see, Jeff in a small town near Indiana. Here, let's listen to what Jeff has to say.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Jeff from a small town near Indianapolis, Indiana. Wanted to leave you some feedback. I have been listening to Catholic Pilots through your podcast since the very early days, and now follow up with Airline Pilot Guy and Catholic Pilot as well. So certainly enjoy and look forward to all of the podcasts that you post every week or so, especially like the Catholic Pilot podcast with your information on your faith and your family, and then also the Airline Pilot Guy and all of the ATC information. It's always interesting to hear what goes on in the cockpit. I am a traveler for work quite a bit and spend a lot of time probably once or twice a month doing some international flights. So I always look forward to hearing some of the information that you provide. A couple of questions that you had asked in your last podcast, most favorite airport. I would have to say for me, even though I do travel internationally, that the airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, for me, ranks as one of the top airports that I've ever been to. living in Indianapolis, as you know, you can't go anywhere internationally from here, so end up routing through Chicago or Newark, generally, if I'm headed to Europe. But the I've always enjoyed when I can get an opportunity to go through the Charlotte airport. The central area there is always pretty cool to go through, and if you've been there to sit on some of the rocking chairs that are sitting out there, are pretty neat as well. A little tip on favorite airlines. I'm not sure I really know who Acme Air is, although I can guess, but I have to say my favorite airlines, I tend to fly United just because I can accumulate all the frequent flyer points on one airline, and it gives me quite a bit of, how can I say, buying power when it's time for an upgrade to first-class cabin, so typically flying business class. Although I will have to say that the most superior service that I've ever received flying internationally has been first class with Lufthansa. I can't even describe. I almost felt guilty sitting in first class there with the amount of service that they provide. Two more quick things. One around people stories. I do appreciate hearing all of the people stories when you put them out there because they are just spot on as I walk through the airport and see people get called to the gate and the flight attendant, or sorry, the gate attendant says, all right, everybody just sit tight and we'll be calling you by rows or by zones here shortly when everybody jumps up and congregates in the area. And it's nearly impossible to walk through as you're trying to get to your gate. All kinds of interesting stories that I can relate to. Hey, oh, just one question I did have for you and to see if you had any particular knowledge in this area. I fly to Ireland probably once every other month, and one of the things that I've experienced as I come back from Ireland, especially flying from Dublin, is that you clear U.S. customs in Ireland versus when you land here in the United States, which although it adds some time on the check-in portion, making sure that you're there on time, it certainly is speeds up the process when you land in the U.S. and it's, you know, can make a connection without having to wait or worry about missing a connection or having a two-hour layover so that you don't miss it and have to go through customs here in the U.S. I'm curious if you know why is it. Ireland is the only country that I have been able to experience that in, with the exception, I think, of Canada. They also did it when I came back from Toronto a couple of years ago. But why is it that you can clear U.S. customs in Ireland and not do it in other countries, or what's special about Ireland? So don't know if you have any information on that, but it'd be great to hear. So thanks so much for your podcast, and look forward to continuing to listen to you.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeff, for your feedback, and thanks for listening. Let's see, I have my fingers up. I'm counting, I think, four different things I want to answer. Let's see, number one, yeah, you're right. I mentioned that, you know, it seems like the number one driver as far as what airlines people fly is cost. And yeah, you have a point there. I think that Jen also sent me some feedback regarding that you know, frequent flyer mileage and other perks and loyalty programs and et cetera often do play a major part of, you know, why people stick to a particular airline. And so that makes sense. So that may be the number one thing for especially for people who fly in their business travel and that kind of thing. So yeah, good point well made. Let's see, number two, Acme, come on, you know, we're based in Atlanta. I live in Atlanta and we fly everywhere in the world. So you probably know what airline I fly for. Three, let's see, I'm holding up my thing. Oh, Charlotte. Yeah, that's a great airport. I fly in and out of there, you know, occasionally. And I agree, that area with the rocking chairs and everything, that is really cool. Although I really never have time to sit down and enjoy the rocking chairs because I'm never there long enough to to do that. But I am there long enough to grab some good barbecue right in that same area. Just on the other side of that NASCAR store is, and I can't remember the name of the company. They have a place at the Raleigh-Durham Airport as well, and it's a pretty darn good barbecue, North Carolina or Carolina-style barbecue. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. And let's see, what was the other thing? Well, how about, I think it was the last thing you talked about, United States Customs border preclearance. And you mentioned that you travel to Ireland quite often, which is, that's cool. Then you also mentioned Canada. And yes, those are two of the countries that do have U.S. Border preclearance facilities. And the other area of the world that has this as well is the Caribbean and Atlantic Ocean. Bermuda started in 1960 and the Bahamas in 1974. Let's see, Aruba, Grand Bahama International Airport in Freeport, the Linden Pindling International Airport in Nassau, and the Bermuda International Airport are the facilities in the Caribbean and Atlantic that operate these facilities. And then many of the big, all the major airports in Canada, Calgary, Edmonton, Halifax, Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, Vancouver, and Winnipeg have U.S. preclearance facilities. Now, you asked why it is that some of these countries have this this policy or this procedure. And it exists, in theory, to provide convenience to travelers from those cities to the U.S. And what it allows you to do is that if you're cleared before you leave your origin, that if you have a connection, say you're flying from Toronto to Atlanta and you're connecting to Dallas or you're connecting to Mobile, Alabama or whatever, you know, if you have to wait until you clear customs in Atlanta, then when you're planning your itinerary, you have to have like a big gap in there to allow for, you know, all the hassle of going through customs. And so I guess the theory is that if you clear customs prior to leaving Toronto or wherever you're flying, that you've now taken away that potential time consumer and you can make a tighter connection. Problem is that, and you probably have experienced this, is that you still have to spend a considerable amount of time in customs, whether you do it at the origin or the destination. But anyway, so in theory, that's why they have these facilities, and I've experienced it too. I used to fly to Canada quite often, and thought it was kind of weird. I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm clearing customs. These are, you know, U.S. customs agents, but we're in Canada. That just, you know, it's kind of scratching my head. I don't really quite understand how that works, but that's the theory behind it. And anybody else out there, if you've experienced the border preclearance facilities and experience, let me know. Let me know how you feel about the whole thing. But anyway, so that's what that's all about. And again, Jeff, thanks for your feedback. And let's see. I also, this is a little bit of a cleanup or update on, let's see, what is it called? I'm looking at a different article here. What is this I'm looking at? Oh, yeah, Light Squared. Remember the 4G broadband technology company that wants to use satellite technology and then a ground-based infrastructure to deliver high-speed broadband technology to all those places out in the middle of nowhere? Great idea, but the problem is, if you recall, the spectrum that they're using from the satellites down to Earth. And the spectrum that they're using is really, really close to the the global positioning satellite spectrum. And there are many agencies within the U.S. government and private aviation as well that are very concerned with the fact that anytime you get close to these GPS wavelengths, that you may actually affect the accuracy of GPS. And because more and more we are relying on GPS signals to navigate, precisely navigate our airplanes, especially when we get close to the ground and runways and such. We don't want any inaccuracy. And apparently, this company was going forward and given the green light by our government. And several people were saying, wait, time out. Let's make sure that this is safe. Just recently, the National Business Aviation Association, the NBAA, welcomed a legislative amendment from Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas to funding a bill that would prohibit the Federal Communications Commission from spending federal funds to deploy LightSquared's 4G broadband technology until it can be proven the technology will not interfere with global positioning system receivers. There's just too much at stake in interfering with a tool we all use and on which our public safety and national security depend so heavily. The FCC must be involved in this process, and the commissioners must require an objective demonstration of non-interference before LightSquared's system gets the go-ahead. GPS is too important for any interference to be tolerated. So hopefully this amendment will pass, and they'll put the brakes on this company going forward with this technology, unless they can prove that it's not going to affect the safety of the public. Okay, and just looking quickly here to see if I missed anything. Yeah, we're getting close to that the end of the podcast. I don't want to go on any further here because it's been I've gone on too long, blabbing too long here. Hope you enjoyed it. If there's anything you want me to talk about, any questions like Todd's question about spins or whatever, just send it in to Catholic Pilot. Let's see, feedback. I'm going back to my old podcast. You can send it there too. feedback@catholicpilot.com. feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And you can send voice feedback to my voice feedback number, which is area code 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. And you can find all that information on my website, airlinepilotguy.com. If you're interested in my occasional Catholic Pilot Extra episodes, in which I talk about more personal things in my life and my faith, head over to CatholicPilot.com, and then you'll get that and the Airline Pilot Guy show as well. And you can always subscribe via iTunes and all that jazz. So here I go, on and on and on. I need to stop talking and get something to eat. It's getting dark outside. Oh, it's rainy and cold here in Dayton. I'll probably stay in the hotel. Don't think I want to venture out. Anyway, thanks for subscribing. Thanks for listening. And until next time, let's see, what do I like to say? Blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.